informational hearing on health pool laws that we passed in 2007, and the overview from the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. So let me open this informational meeting, and we'll start off with the overview of the board with Steve McNanny, Joan Kapowicz. If you both want to come up at the same time and present simultaneously, I do want to recognize Representative Reed, who's joined us today and looking out for his Beaverton School District, and can chime in if need be, but is just on hand to lend expertise to this issue. So, welcome.
Thank you.
I'll let you start.
Thank you, Chairman Bass, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to comment and report how OEB has been doing. For the record, my name is Steve McNanny, and I'm the chair of the OEB board. Have joined me today, I have Joan Kapowicz, who is the administrator of the OEB and the Public Employee Benefit Board. And we also have with us today Steve Carlson, who is the Northwest Practice Leader for Watson Wyatt Worldwide and the Consulting Actuary for OEB, in case we have any specific questions which would be appropriate for him to address. Before I turn it over to Joan to update you on the status of OEB to date, I think it's significant to note that when Senate Bill 426 was passed, it was designed to be phased in over a three-year period with about 20 to 25,000 members joining each year based on the end dates of their collective bargaining agreements. The first year enrollment was much higher than anticipated, with over 62,000 employees and a total covered lives, including dependents, in excess of 146,000. The magnitude of the enrollment stretched the resources for OEB. However, Joan and her staff did a remarkable job of managing what is the largest healthcare enrollment that's ever occurred in the state. We've been at it. The plan has been operational now for about 120 days since October 1st, and I think I'd like to have Joan talk about some of the successes OEB has experienced, as well as some of the challenges we face in the future.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joan Kapowicz, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. The OEB is created under the Department of Administrative Services and created for the purpose of pooling employee benefits to provide benefits for the employees and families of education service districts and school districts throughout the state, and to provide a benefit that was high quality but also protected the taxpayers and the districts of this state. This changed. OEB changed the way benefits were provided in the state. Previous to OEB coming in, into fruition, we had brokers, health trusts, direct right insurance being provided. And when OEB started on October 1st, 2008, it changed the landscape. One of the first official actions of the members of the board, including Steve McNanny, our chair, in July after they were confirmed by the Senate, was to select a health insurance consulting firm to help us make decisions about what the benefit plans would look like that needed to be comparable to those that were in existence today. So they put out a request for proposal. We're able to select Watson Wyatt, an international healthcare consulting firm. Watson Wyatt then started in September of 2007 and began immediately to go through tremendous amounts of data from healthcare brokerages, the trusts, and other sources to determine what was the status of healthcare being provided in the state to this population at the time. What they came up with, what they synthesized, there were basically nine different health plans, and so they designed nine health plan options, four pharmacy options, eight dental plan options, and five vision care options that would represent comparable benefits to what was out there at the current time. And those would become the choices. In addition, we added to the benefit design a zero copay option in terms of services. So 17 preventive services would have no copayment to encourage members to get immunizations, have mammograms, those kinds of things, which we know will prevent future healthcare costs. OEB released these plans through the request for proposal process in January of 2008, and we had 30 insurers bid on this business. Those insurers had to complete exhaustive questionnaires that had been designed by Watson Wyatt, answering questions about their financial stability, what rates they would offer, panel membership, accounts, customer service, and, of course, the quality of care provided to the members. Those questionnaires were scored by Watson Wyatt, and those scores then tabulated up, and they recommended to the Request for Proposal Committee of the Board, made up of 7 of 10 members of the Board, that they would then be interviewing those 22 bidders. After those bids were complete, the full Board decided on the apparent successful proposer selection, and that was at the end of April this past year. And those proposers that were selected were Willamette Dental, ODS Health Plans, Kaiser Health Plan, and Providence Health Plan. And then over the next 3 weeks until the middle of May, rate negotiations were underway. We concluded rate negotiations, announced the rates, and were able to gain a 3-year guaranteed rate for the administrative cost of the program, which is the only kind of guarantee that we're aware of in the state at this time. Then we had the job of enrolling the districts and entities in the program. Entities could choose for their member groups up to 4 medical plans, 1 pharmacy plan, 3 dental plans, and 2 vision plans. And so we needed to advise and help them make some of those choices. Those choices and then how many people would be coming into our plan became known to us around that time. So we knew we were going to have a very large enrollment. Following in the months of the summer and into August and September when open enrollment occurred, we made over 205 presentations across the state to school districts, education service districts, and community colleges who were coming into OEB to explain the benefits to them, to show them how they could enroll in the system, answer all kinds of questions. So it was a fairly daunting effort across the state. One of the reasons we were able to successfully enroll 145,645 lives under this program was that we had developed an online enrollment system called MyOEB. It was designed in coordination with stakeholders across the state from our districts and stakeholders to help us make the system as good as it could be. It's an online system, so it replaced paper-based enrollment that many health carriers, and particularly in this population, used until this time. Similarly, the premiums were also all paper-based, and this system replaces that. During the 2007 legislative session, there were estimates of what the savings of MyOEB pool would be, and those estimated savings were that it would be about 5% administrative savings. Our actuary, Watson Wyatt, estimated that the savings we actually achieved were 4.8% administrative savings of about $37 million. The board is now moving toward, in addition to our keeping up the program that we have going, the board is moving forward with other benefit options outlined by statute. Last October, the board decided to offer the required long-term care insurance to our members in October of 2010. The following month in November, they decided to offer optional benefits, life insurance, disability insurance, accidental death and dismemberment insurance. Those will be offered this October. And the savings estimate for that program in 1 year is estimated to be $660,000, with savings split between districts of about districts 2/3 of that savings, members about 1/3. There were challenges, as Steve referred to. The timeline of this program was aggressive, and the numbers of people we had to enroll were large. We had another issue arise in that the panel providers in the Eastern Oregon area were not as fully contracted as they might have been on October 1st. That has improved significantly in the time since we've been up, and we expect it to be fully resolved in the near future. Because we recognize the importance of access, we really will not rest until this matter is resolved. Other opportunities we had for enhancements were numerous. I mentioned the MyOEB online enrollment system, which will continue to have enhancements over the coming year in report writing that districts can pull from the system for their own benefit, as well as some financial invoicing improvements. We also used the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, a program, state-sponsored program that began in 2003. It provides the pharmacy benefits to most largest proportion of our members. And once the contracts were awarded, and they were to be one of the contractees, their panel membership grew by 60 pharmacies in-state, including Costco, and by about 2,000 pharmacies nationwide. So we were glad that the additional membership allowed them to grow and serve our members and those throughout Oregon who belong to OPDP. We also have developed a comparability assessment and policy, which is attached for your review. For those small number of districts who feel that the benefit offered by OEB is not comparable to the benefit they currently have, they make a request of us, submit information, and our actuary determines whether or not the benefits are comparable. Last fall, we performed this assessment for Bethel School District in the Eugene area, and we found that their benefit was, in fact, not comparable to the OEB benefits, so they would not be required to come in. However, Bethel chose to send in one of their employee groups because for that employee group, they felt the benefits, they had more options to choose among, and they did save some money. So that same process will be used for any district, be it Beaverton or another, to determine if comparability has been met. Last, because of the unexpected number of employees that came into, members that came in under our program, we were able to generate more administrative fees earlier in the program, and we had an obligation to pay back our $4.9 million in general fund by the end of the next biennium. However, we believe we will be able to do this earlier, and we will be presenting that option and request to our board tomorrow at their monthly board meeting. With that, I'll close and ask if there are any questions. We'd be happy to answer them, and thank you for the opportunity to present.
Well, thank both of you. First of all, appreciate your willingness to come in and talk about this and have a good, candid, I think, you know, hashing out the opinions. I also thank you for not doing a PowerPoint. Mr. Morrison and I just sat through three PowerPoints on revenue issues next door, and I think three PowerPoints one day is probably enough.
That's blinding.
For any brain.
Slightly brain damage.
Yeah. Colleagues, before we get to questions, I thought perhaps it might be helpful if we heard from the Beaverton School District. Debbie Johnson is here. If it's all right, Ms. Johnson, if you could just join them there. I know you have some prepared testimony and have perhaps some difference of opinions. And to the OEBB board, I don't want you to think that you're in a rough room here, but I should point out that there are some perhaps a legitimate subjective opinions here. You have two senators up here who voted against this bill on the floor before it became law. I wasn't here in 07, so
you get a pass.
Yeah, but so that's the room you're dealing with, and I really do want to have just a frank hashing out of this to see what it looks like now and air some of these differences, and maybe we need legislation to tweak this, or maybe we don't. Ms. Johnson, thank you.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Debbie Johnson. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm the health resource coordinator for Beaverton School District. We're very pleased that we were asked to speak today, and I appreciate it. And also, Senator Haas, we have testified before. Beaverton has been consistent in our message. We've testified before the Ways and Means Committee prior to this becoming a law in 2007. So I appreciate this opportunity. There are no enemies here. I think we just have, as you said, difference of opinion. And Beaverton has a particular message that we've been very clear on since the beginning. And the message is that we want an opt-out provision in the statute. Upon advice that we've received, there is no opt-out provision, a total opt-out provision. There is a, as Joan mentioned, four districts or four groups came to OEB to ask for a waiver, but that they're not under any obligation to provide that in the statute. So that is what we're asking for in this current legislative session. We have communicated with our community, with our Beaverton legislators, with other school districts who are in the same situation that we are at, according to a recent attachment from OEB of July 31st, 2008. There are 18 entities that are not in OEB. And of those, many of those are self-insured school districts. We are not self-insured in Beaverton, but those school districts are already meeting to come together with their legislators in order to come up with some legislation that would assist us. We're not against particularly what OEB is doing. We understand their challenges and what they were asked to do. We just want to be sure that we have an option out. The reason? Cost. We already have an economic forecast from last Friday, and that's why there aren't a lot of people here from Beaverton with me today, because we're busy working on a $5 to $10 million shortfall so that we can finish the school year, and our Beaverton legislators are aware of that already. So I provided for this group today a simple handout. It's the same message we've been sending since the beginning of 2008, and that is our estimated financial impact. We have disagreements, I'm sure, with the OEB people that our numbers are inflated for our what the cost would have been had we entered in September 1 of 2008. But needless to say, even someone on the governor's office has looked at this separately from us and shared with us that maybe it's not $8.6 million, it's probably closer to $4.5 million, but that it costs more this year than our current plan. But that's still too much, especially when we've already reduced our budget by $6.2 million before this next $5 to $10 million has been asked of us. So it's too much for us. And in addition to this, our retirees, we've appealed to our retirees, and they have communicated with AARP Oregon of their concerns. And our retirees, if we go into comparable plans with OEB, they would be paying between $600 to $2,400 more per year, depending upon the OEB plan they selected. And I know, and I talk with neighboring school districts, and in the Hillsborough School District, there are classified employees who are currently paying $200 more per month, actually, for their health plan when they transitioned over. So you may or may not have heard that directly from people who are impacted by this. On the back side of the page, I laid out what our 208-209 contract year look like. Based on the way that we're funded with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, it's an experience-rated refunding mechanism. That's why you'll see our settlement excess reserve. What that means is after claims are paid, there's an adjustment for any administrative expenses. And then there's, if we're fortunate, there's a balance. That is not a one-year balance. That's a cumulative balance over 3 years. That $3.5 million, $2 million of it was used this year to reduce our cost directly to the health plans. That's what the money can only be used for. We have to hold $1.5 in reserves that cannot be touched unless there's some kind of break in the plan where we'd have to pay out claims. So we use that $2 million already without having to cut jobs or cut teachers from our district. So that's how we come up with our current total will be for the 208-209 fiscal year, $40.9 million.
Okay.
We compared ourselves to what OEB would have had us in, or what our people thought we were comparable to, even though there may be discretion there. And we would have paid close to $49 million with no potential reserves to us based on our experience. And this has been 25 years of working together with our associations in providing quality health care in a timely way for everyone is required under our current laws of our pre-Medicare retirees and our active employees.
Okay. I thank you for that, and I do appreciate your spirit of there are no enemies here, and I think we all agree with that, and I think nobody argues with the idea of using a pool to lower all health care. I think we can get there, but, you know, I guess the question's to the OEBB folks are pretty self-evident, and why, what do you say to an opt-out clause, and why isn't it clearly stated here? Would it be better if there weren't, or could you speak, if it were in there, and could you speak to those issues that were raised by Ms. Johnson?
Well, Senator Hassan, we want to see the district go wherever the best deal is. We have no vested interest if they're getting a better deal with Regents or as a direct right. That's the reason we established the comparability test, and we used it in the past, and it did work. And for those districts that we couldn't make comparability on because they had a better pricing through their current carrier, and specifically I'll cite Bethel, we waive the requirement that you come in, as stated in the statute. So it's the board's policy, and has really been the intent, that we are not trying to force anybody into this that has a better deal. But I think if you look at it collectively, we will all agree that pooling this generally works better for the majority of people. But there are going to be those groups that have better experience. And for those groups, we want to have some sort of a policy in place that allows the comparability test and for them to be excluded from the OEB programs.
To be fiscally prudent, however, we can't budget every year for a potential $8 million cost to join or whatever it will cost us. We've been consistently below not only OEB but OSBA when OSBA was operating as a plan, and we can show data to show that. So our CFO wanted the point brought across that it's just not fiscally prudent, especially in these economic times, for her to try to set aside money in case every year when we go through comparability we don't meet it. And other insurance professionals have talked with us and said that a more accurate picture of a group's health plan experience, like Beaverton's, we're considered a mature group and actuarially credible for experience. We just ask that the legislatures consider that the analysis not be done every year. And we discussed that in a letter to the OEB chair, that we don't feel but they're locked into the statute. They have to follow what the statute asks them to do. So we're just asking that comparability analysis not be annually. OEB could have a bad year. We could have a bad year. And then once you're in OEB, you're in. And that means you're in for the optional benefits that they're proposing October 1 of 2009, which is their life LTD. I've been and I'm sure Joan and Steve see me at the board meetings, and now that it's on the web, I can watch from my office while I'm working. So I've been very visible, very present since 2007 at most, if not all, board meetings, and also in any public hearing that OEB has held. So not all districts can afford someone to be there, to be present, and I appreciate the opportunity to be involved, so I'm not just speaking off the hip about that we just don't want to join. That's not the point. The point is being fiscally prudent to our community, and Beaverton community members do trust us, I believe, in the management of all of the programs that we do, not just the employee health care program. So I do ask today that the committee look at or consider that as an option if OEB will continue as it has been, looking at more than a one-year comparability analysis.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I guess my question would be, rather than have OEB be in a position to grant or not grant a waiver to a district, shouldn't it be up to the district to decide whether they want to join or not based on their review of the data? And so I'm wondering if we don't have the decision matrix pointed the wrong direction here.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, you're set up now. You're a full-blown service provider. If we followed the path that Senator Cruz was suggesting, that it essentially be a market-driven service, so that your constituents would have the ability to come and go based on the savings, or if there are no savings and they have a different direction, what would that do to your plan? And could you make a market-driven service provider concept work?
Chairman Hatch, Senator Morris, it's a very interesting question, and I think I'd like to have our actuary respond to it because I think there's some implications to the rating structure and what might happen to a pool that where the comings and goings are the hard part to manage. So could I defer that to Steve Carlson to help us with that?
Sure.
Absolutely.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Steve Carlson, consulting actuary with Watson Wyatt. And the question, I believe, was what would occur, what might be some of the implications if there was the opportunity for districts to make their own decision about whether or not to participate in OEB. One of the underlying principles of the Senate bill from a couple of years ago was the idea of mandatory pooling, and the reason why the mandatory pooling was put forward for the consideration of the legislature was that when you have a mandatory pooling approach, then this up and down in experience that any one district might experience essentially is taken off the table in any given year, and you get a certain level of rate stability as you go forward year after year after year, and that benefits all participants in the pool over a long period of time. At any given moment in time, any given year, it may or may not have a tremendous advantage for every single district, but over a longer period of time, by having everyone in, you don't have this selection occurring, which means that, you know, those who at that moment can achieve, take their better experience and go somewhere else, do so, leaving the rest to pay more behind. So it does require, you know, this concept of mandatory pooling, for it to work well over the long term, it does require everyone to stay in, but it also requires everyone to essentially be in it together. And that's, I recognize that that can be a challenging concept.
We have an estimation of savings. Looks like it's pretty close to $38 million. Do you have a distribution of the winners and losers in that calculation?
Yeah, we've done some. In addition to calculating the overall savings, we have randomly selected some districts to just look at kind of the range of what occurred, and we had a range in our looking at those districts. We had a range anywhere from 1% savings, so very little in the way of 1 year savings, all the way up to 18% savings, depending on the district, and then of course there were a small handful of districts who, when the comparability test was done, didn't pass or whatever. I believe that Mr. McNanny was referring to Bethel School District as an example, and so then that they would be an example of one that where the savings didn't show at all.
So if again, a follow up, Mr. Chair,
please.
So you really don't have a calculation based on all of the districts, but it's just a sampling of the districts, which raises the question of the accuracy of your projection.
Let me just address that. No, the projection is based on all the districts, but in terms of not all of the districts. Not all of the districts actually received renewals for the 2008-2009 year. So to be able to precisely say what any given district has saved as a result of OEB is challenging, because all we necessarily had for each district was perhaps some older data from the last year that they were not in OEB. And so, and again, it's important to compare apples to apples in terms of the timing of the rates. So that's the reason why we have not necessarily been able to pinpoint it for each individual district.
And also, it would seem apples to apples, apples to oranges. In Beaverton's case, almost, you know, totally different plans. Go ahead.
Chairman, Senator Moritz, let me try and expand one. I'll take one stab at it, not being an actuary. I think we looked at the dollars in aggregate. We looked at what was the total being spent for the entire group that went in statewide, and then we compared it to what was being spent currently. We did not go in and slice it for every district so that we could have a complete list of how much was saved by each district. But we did do some samplings. We tried to do it, you know, with different geographical areas, different sizes of districts, to make sure that it supported the overall assumptions of looking at it from an aggregate standpoint. And I think in every case we found every district that entered in saved some, but some of the savings were like 1%, and as Mr. Carlson has pointed out, somewhere as high as 18%.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make a comment based on what Chair Haas said about some of the members voted against the bill in 2007, and the Chair wasn't here in 2007. Mm-hmm. He says he reacts with a smile.
Yeah.
And some of us voted for the bill based on the provision that a district would not need to enter the pool if they were going to see a reduction in benefits or an increase in costs. And I remember quite clearly the discussions about that provision at the time of the vote. So I wanted to clarify that. And then I wanted to respond to the, and I'm in that category as well as many of my colleagues formerly in the House. I wanted to respond to the point that Mr. Carlson made about the mandatory nature of pooling. And I think that argument would make more sense if, in fact, OEB was mandatory for all districts, but it's not, because there are particular groups that aren't required to go in, those that are self-insured and those who have independent health insurance trusts. So it starts out without being mandatory for all. So I think that there's a little logical problem with saying that that's the benefit of it being mandatory when it isn't, in fact, mandatory. I can understand rate stability, but when it's not mandatory for everyone, it isn't truly mandatory. And I had a question about comparability. And I believe, I'm sorry, Ms. Kapowicz said, when she was talking about the comparability determinations, she used the term our actuary. And with all due respect to Mr. Carlson, it's my understanding that you are doing your comparability analysis on behalf of OEB. And we all understand that there are, you know, we're talking about comparing apples to apples and making sure that the benefit plans are compared equally. But if you're doing the analysis on behalf of OEB, Mr. Carlson, and Beaverton's getting their analysis on behalf of someone who it's in their interest to have the numbers favor Beaverton, I would like the three of you or whomever is capable of discussing what would be involved in having an independent analysis of comparability, so it's not coming from one side or another and truly having that neutral assessment of whether the benefits are comparable. Anybody want to take a stab at that? Thank you.
We're all shying away from this, Senator Chairman Haas, Senator Bonamici. I think you have a couple of questions there that are very good. And I think regarding an independent actuary doing it, I think there's obviously no reason that couldn't happen. It would be who is going to pay for it and what would the process be. And would the process always be consistent if you have different actuaries doing it for different districts? You know, we have confidence that Watson Wyatt in their process will administer the comparability test in the same way. And this comparability test, as we talk about it, and I think Joan Kapowicz has probably with her a little more explanation of about it we could share with you, But it is the process of building the benefit plans in, in an automated system, and then we're running claims against it. And I think the claims data set that we used was 3.5 million people. What would their normal claims be? We run all of those through each plan, and therefore you figure out what would be the payment that comes out on the other side of that, and therefore you determine what is, you know, if the plan is comparable. If there were, one plan would have paid less, then obviously it's not comparable if it's not within 2.5% of the base plan. So I guess my concern would be, Senator, if we don't believe in the one actuarial study, will it be consistently applied across the board? Would everybody, and I don't think, I'll have to ask Mr. Carlson, I'm not sure everybody would have access to the same data set. We couldn't apply the same claims. We couldn't use the same process in theory. That would be my only concern. Whether an independent could do it, sure, and I think then it would just be who would pay for it.
Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. What would you consider to be the minimum threshold of covered lives to have a viable plan?
Are you referring to minimum number of lives for OEB to be viable, or
You have 146,000 presently covered lives.
Mm-hmm.
What would be that minimum threshold to still provide the same kinds of benefits that you anticipate being able to provide now? In other words, Beaverton, how many covered lives does Beaverton have?
Close to 8,000.
8,000. Mm-hmm. So what kind of erosion could you afford if you were in a market-driven system and still provide the same benefits that you think that you're providing?
Right. I guess a couple of points about that. One would be that the number of covered lives is important, and once you have probably anything in the range of 20, 30, 40,000 covered lives, as long as those lives are the same and not changing significantly from year to year, then you can have stability. That really brings me to my second point, which is the concern about a mandatory or not mandatory approach to a pool like this has more to do with comings and goings out of the pool, which is the selection I was referring to before, that if you have districts or groups coming in and out of OEB when it happens to favor them and then going away when it happens to not favor them, that would be a significant concern just from an insurance perspective. It becomes very difficult to have stability at that point. But in terms of just a pure number of lives, if the lives are consistent and not coming and going, OEB is already at what I would describe as a stable level.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. This reminds me a little bit of House Bill 2002, which you're not familiar with, but it was a pooling of small 2 to 25 employer groups, employers, and 26 to 50, and it was portrayed as a cost reduction in health insurance, and that there would be some winners and some losers. And what we're finding is, you know, the losers are losing a lot, and the winners are not winning much. And that may be a very, very poor analogy, but it's the same concept of pooling, and I tell you, the environment we're in, it's hard to sit here as a legislator and tell the city or the Beaverton School District your costs are going to go up. That's a very hard thing to do in this environment.
Thank you, Senator. Steve, you may have hit on this, but if I can get you to maybe go back and just briefly, these two questions. Tell me what it would do to the plan that exists now, and that is this opt-out provision that we're talking about for districts who can demonstrate their costs are below what they would be. And number two, looking at a comparability analysis that is longer than the one-year analysis, 2 years, 3 years, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of what an opt-out provision might, how that might affect OEB, one of the concerns that I would have is I would have some concern about rate stability for those who remained in the pool. And the other thing that I would have some concern about is, as Mr. McNanny was indicating, if we have some different methods being applied to determine whether or not an opt-out is warranted, then there could be some, there could be some reasons for not wanting to be a part of the pool that might go beyond cost savings, so there would be some concern that the districts may not realize the savings that they could over a longer term, based on some other shorter term issue. But in terms of the impact on OEB, I'll just go back to what I was saying in response to Senator Morse, that if we, as long as we don't have groups coming in and out when it favors them, then there would not be a significant impact to OEB. If we do have groups coming in and out, depending on when in a given year it favors them, we will not have a viable entity for anyone. So it's very critical, I think.
In the 2 year, in the longer term comparison.
I guess given the nature of health costs fluctuating from year to year, I can see rationale for looking at a longer period of time. From a theoretical perspective, from a practical perspective, I'm wondering, would we be able to maintain and access the data that was needed to do it over multiple years? That would be my, so from a practical perspective, I'm not quite sure how it would work. From a theoretical perspective, I think it's fine, it's acceptable.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I just want to clarify one thing to make sure that I understand this correctly. When Chair Haas asked you about why wouldn't a district who could show lower cost be able to opt out, what would that do to stability, and you said you would be concerned about rate stability for those in the pool, but previously you said that there are enough in the pool now to have stability. So I want to just clarify that Beaverton is not in the pool now, so we're not talking about a district leaving the existing pool and then perhaps coming back in later. We're talking about a district that's not in the pool yet, and the pool is already stable. So I want to make sure that that's clear. Is that correct, my understanding?
That's correct. I didn't mean to imply that Beaverton was in the pool and somehow it would jeopardize the pool for them to leave. So.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that's clear. Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought Senator Bonamici was going to ask my question, but she almost did. Quite simply because you said that at 30, 40,000 lives you were stable, and you're at 146,000 lives now, but you're saying that if for somebody to opt out creates instability. So I'm kind of wondering, just looking at the economies of scale here, if you had, for example, a district with 10,000 lives opting out, so, which takes you to 136,000, which is still well above your 40,000, how that creates instability. I don't think I understand that.
That's an actuary.
I'll start, and Mr. McNanny may help me translate. the stability that I'm concerned about is really what's called underwriting or actuarial selection. That when a group or a subgroup, in this case, let's just say a district or a group, when they perceive that their experience is more favorable and that they should go out and obtain their own insurance rate based on their own experience, then in the short run, they may in fact be able to do so, and they will pull that good experience out of the group that they're, the larger group that they're a part of, and get a short-term better deal. At some point, almost for sure, that particular group will have things reverse for them, at which point they may become interested in rejoining the larger pool because it will benefit them. And when they do that, then that will not be good for the larger pool that remained before. So it's a timing issue. And when groups stay together, then they create stability over multiple years for each other because they all have good and bad years at any given time. When they are allowed to come and go, when it's to their advantage, then you lose that stability. I'm not sure that I'm addressing your specific question.
Well, probably not. And quite honestly, Mr. Chair, if I could, you know, I mean, bouncing in and out on a year-to-year basis is problematic. I could understand that. I guess what I'm saying is if a district that is currently in the board, in OEB, chose to leave OEB because they thought they could get a better deal someplace else, and they leave. They're gone. They're no longer part of your group. How that would create a stability problem, because that's not a churning thing. They're just no longer there.
Pardon me? Yeah. Senator Cruz, I think the problem it might create, I don't think if, as you have noted and Mr. Carlson says, once you get to about 20 to 30,000 mm-hmm. lives, it becomes actuarially stable. I'm not sure any district is at that, one district is at that level. So one district leaving doesn't present the problem. The problem comes when their experience, if and when their experience goes bad, they want back in. You know, now they've taken it, you know, they're going to bring their bad experience in and somebody else wants to leave with the good experience. It's the comings and goings that make the management of the pool the most difficult. I think it's also worth noting that we believe, well, of course, OEB believes we have a process by which we are not forcing anybody in if the comparability test shows that they're getting a better deal. We think they should stay out and just be tested again at some point. Now, whether that's every year as the legislation currently DOJ has advised us, or if it's every 2 years or every 3 years, is somewhat argumentative. But the point is they're on the tightrope with a safety net of OEB below them with a large pool. We also have to go through that testing process for those that are not in the pool currently that are exempt. As Senator Bonamici had mentioned, there are a number of districts that are exempt from the pool, but they also have that testing requirement in 2010. Are they going to be able to prove that they have a better plan than what is offered through OEB at a comparable price? So I think they're, you know, even though that group has to go through that, I think there's a couple of things we could do, and we're not disputing Debbie's numbers. I very much respect her, and she's been at our meetings and had valuable input and given us great direction on a number of issues. But we could also just get this a little bit more narrowed down by doing the testing on Beaverton School District and say, where are they at this point? They're not required to come in because I think they have a collective bargaining agreement that goes to 2010. But we could do it. We could look at that in advance and say, where do we stand? I also think as we start to look at evaluating the program that has been really up and running about 120 days since October, there is a provision within this legislation for a task force to report back in 2011. I hate to make too many changes after 120 days, so I hope that we do take a look at that and understand there is a group that is in the legislation that is designated to come and evaluate us and report back to you rather than having our vested interest or my point of view as being the one evaluation. Thank you.
I think we all understand the difficulty of having districts coming in and out and how that would not work. Ms. Johnson, you had some... You were shaking and nodding. And
yes, I just wanted to make a correction that Beaverton is subject to the comparability analysis. We were just notified in this month from Glenn Bailey from OEB that we needed to provide our comparability information to OEB because of the October 1, 2009 requirement for The majority of our employee groups that are subject, our teachers are not subject till October 1 of 2010. So we have provided that information, and I know Steve will agree that Beaverton has been in compliance with every request and has also been forthright in our information and in working with our legislators in providing our message clearly as to what it is that we are trying to do. I would say that to the committee members that this plan is not really mature yet. It's only been in operation since October. We probably will not see any drastic rate increases, even though there are no rate guarantees in their arrangements with their carriers. But they only have 5 months of experience to rate on, if that. So this year is not the year for them to say that they're successful yet, because we heard the savings of $32 million and one claim hadn't even been paid yet under the plan. So we are concerned, as Senator Morse brought up, with the accuracy of savings, which I know they are going to have to address in the task force. But, again, that's not till the end of the next biennium, and we're already hurting now. We're hurting now for our staff, for our just dollars in general, education dollars. I think the pool will get smaller, unfortunately, because all districts will have to face reduction in force at some point of our employees. We'll all be losing employees in all our districts, and Beaverton is not alone in that.
May I add one other comment? We were addressing the issue of stability, and we used that issue, that word quite a bit in the last few minutes. There was one other element that I wanted to add in that really doesn't have so much to do with stability, but economies of scale. And so as we have more and more, larger and larger membership, we can pass that stability threshold at a lower level, but we continue to gain the benefit of economies of scale pretty much indefinitely, so we can spread the administrative cost of the program across a larger group. So if the pool is smaller, that is one way in which all would be disadvantaged, is the administrative costs would become higher per person.
I think it's a fair comment, so I think that's probably the draw of the concept to begin with.
Just a comment, not a question. It has only been up and running for a short period of time, and so the savings estimates are clearly estimates at this point. And I was reminded, of things that start up and look good. When we went into managed care, it was supposed to be dramatic savings, and it was for a short period of time, and then it took off like everything else did. So I think this needs some additional thought, Mr. Chair. So,
okay. I thank you. I do, colleagues, just to put this in perspective, the Beaverton School District has this incredible relationship with the voters there, and they're nothing if they're not prudent. Evidence was in, some of you might remember Measure 30 that we passed, that became Measure 30, was thumped the polls statewide. A few months later, Beaverton voters passed a three-year operating levy for their school district, in effect raising their property taxes in a recession not too far from what we're experiencing now. And they passed it. It's 3 years. So that is dramatic enough. A year goes by, another year goes by, and the board and the district said, we're not exactly in the emergency that we were 3 years ago, so we're not going to take this third year. In effect, we're going to cut your taxes and return this money. And it's why they have this relationship with voters that they enjoy today. So I do appreciate you being prudent with the tax dollars there and for bringing this forward. And I really do hope that we can work this out. Before we close out on this, I do want to call up Susan Weeks.
I'm sorry, she's
okay. You're okay with this issue.
Good cover.
My mistake. I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
I'll close that informational meeting on the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. And Ms. Week, so sorry. I want you to speak on this, but also on the overview of your priorities for the state board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Weeks. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Strategic Programs and Planning with the Oregon University System. I want to point out that you will have momentarily a packet of information, the cover page of which is a table that's in blue and white, so I wanted to be able to refer to that every so often during my testimony. I've been with the Chancellor's Office for 29 years, so I've seen good times and bad times, and I guess it's stating the obvious to say that good times are a lot more fun, and I don't envy you the task that you have ahead of you and that we all have ahead of us. These are pretty tough times. That said, I want to focus my overview of our legislative priorities on, first of all, the successes and the very good returns on the previous investments the state has made in higher education, and as well as talk about some of the challenges. But I want to also address how the university system and the state board is addressing those kinds of challenges and what some of the things are ahead of us and what our thoughts are about how you might address them as well. Let me start with the first page of that packet, which is a table that says where Oregon ranks on selected national indicators related to public four-year education. This comes from, and I will take a moment to shamelessly promote our new Oregon University System fact book, which is just hot off the press, and you will all be receiving copies of this very soon. The data on this table and in the several pages behind it come from the new fact book. And the indicators that I have pulled out here for discussion today are indicators that show, first of all, the New Economy Index, which is not a higher education indicator, but it is an index of indicators that relate to the knowledge economy. This is a 2007 update. The original index was 2002. And Oregon's rank, as you can see on here, is pretty high. It was actually higher in 2002. I think we ranked 12th at that point. But on these measures related to the New Economy Index, Oregon does relatively well. And a lot of these measures are related to higher education and post-secondary education generally. Right below that is the percent of population with a bachelor's degree or higher. We currently are 18th. Again, a pretty high ranking. The one below that, enrollment per 10,000 people, we rank 31st, not a very high ranking. And I think that's important to note in the context of these other two, because having people enrolled and in the pipeline is critical to achieving the other two measures, achieving success on those measures of both having a population with high educational attainment and a competitive position on the New Economy Index relative to other states. We do pretty well in awarding our bachelor's degrees through our public universities, ranking 22nd compared to other states. Likewise, our graduation rate, not where we want. We have aspirations to improve that, and since we're taking steps to make improvements in completion and retention, but nevertheless, compared to other states, we rank relatively high. The next two indicators, I think, are pretty interesting and very critical to our enterprise. The federal research and development dollars per faculty, we rank 7th, and this we've actually had a pretty high ranking over the past several years. We have very productive faculty researchers.
Is that OHSU?
It includes OHSU. Also includes.
So is that the reason it's higher? Or take it.
It's not the only reason. Okay. We've seen some tremendous efforts and increases, particularly at University of Oregon and Oregon State University, as well as OHSU. Other universities are all of the other universities are increasing in this measure, but the biggest contributors are the three that I've mentioned. Portland State is up and coming, and so it's starting to make some real inroads into that number as well. We rank 7th nationally on that measure. Looking right below that, our faculty compensation and public doctoral granting universities, if you look at salary, only 46th, even when you add benefits, 37th. So you put those two together and you see a picture that isn't particularly sustainable. The only way you're going to have that success with the research and development is if you have a strong core faculty and you can recruit and retain them. And so this is a vulnerability I want to be sure to point out. Our average tuition and fees for first-time, full-time freshmen, we were about in the middle nationally. A little bit below the average in dollar amount and about in the middle across the 50 states. Student debt at graduation, this measure does not reflect the new investments in the opportunity grant. And so this is for the class of 2007. Nationally, you don't want to have a high ranking on this one. We're 19th. It's higher than we would want. But again, we would expect to see that go down with continued investment in the opportunity grant in the shared responsibility model. And then finally, the bottom line there, the state appropriation per FTE, we're 45th. Not a good place to be, although I have to say it's an improvement from where we have been. And that's a pretty sad story. So this, I think, gives you a feel for where we have some strengths, where we've made some progress, where we're competitive, but where some of our vulnerabilities are as well. And then one final point, I don't have a statistic on the page, but I do want to point out that in terms of administrative support and efficiency, that our OUS institutions spend less on administration and physical plant than our peers do. So we're relatively efficient in administrative costs and support. Our universities and certainly the State Board of Higher Education see job one for OUS as increasing educational attainment for Oregon and competitiveness for Oregon as well. And we see five mechanisms, I guess, for lack of a better term, to achieve that, first being having a diverse array of high-quality institutions. We have among our institutions in our system a mix of mission, size, programs, and geographic location to serve the variety of needs in a very large and diverse state. The second is a focus on student success, helping students to enter college, learn effectively, and complete degrees, preparing them for high-wage jobs. That's our job one. In the next few years, we know from data that we've received from the Employment Division that at least three-quarters of high-wage jobs will require at least a bachelor's degree or graduate degree to be competitive. And so that is, we never lose sight of that focus. And overall, preparing Oregonians for the knowledge economy. Third one is the development of strong economic drivers, and this includes, as I've mentioned, faculty research and innovation, capital construction, which provides jobs, and sometimes jobs very immediately, and then clean technologies, developing new technologies in the context of what's sustainable both for Oregon and in developing cutting-edge industry in the clean technologies area. Fourth, critical partnerships. Partnerships within OUS and across the education continuum, including K-12 and community colleges and private schools. I have, as part of this packet, once you get past the data pieces, but there is a page also from our fact book, OUS Degree Partnership Programs, and that lists for each of our institutions the degree partnership programs they have with specific community colleges. And finally, having an effective and supportive policy infrastructure, policy and operating principles and regulation, an overall support structure that provides the ability to be efficient and effective in how we manage our system. One example of that is the proposed ability to retain interest earnings, which is one of our legislative concepts that would materially allow us to manage more efficiently and effectively. The Board of Higher Education has a long-range strategic plan and with broad goals, guiding principles, and a set of strategic priorities. The two most critical right now of the priorities that the board is pursuing are first in the area of educational attainment and student success. There is a board committee on student participation and completion which has engaged communities and students and folks from all over the state, particularly looking at the underserved student population, those who are low income, first generation, rural, students of color, a lot of different communities of students and people who traditionally have not participated in higher education. That is a major focus of the board now, to improve the educational attainment level of that population. And then secondly, advancing innovation for Oregon's economic vitality. A couple of examples are ONAMI, the Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, Oregon Best, the Built Environment Sustainable Technologies. The board has recently established a sustainability initiatives committee to try and coordinate a broad array of academic program, research, campus operations, and capital project efforts around sustainability in a way that is coordinated and supportive of where the state as a whole would like to go. And then also there is a Portland Higher Education Committee that continues to address the particular needs of the Portland area, trying to coordinate, trying to, it's a rapidly growing area, as you know, and so trying to make sure that the higher education needs of Portland are served effectively, efficiently, and in coordination with our partners. We're building our priorities from a perspective of this being a multi-biennial strategy, not just a single legislative session. We had a successful, we think, legislative session last time, thanks to you all. We had some good, we were able to make some good investments in our operating budget, in affordability through the Opportunity Grant, in capital construction, and in innovation through the Oregon Inc. and the Signature Research Center. So we are building from some real strengths and some momentum. Going into the 2009-11 session, the governor has proposed a budget that continues that, and that with the perspective that these efforts will contribute in very immediate as well as long-term ways to the health of Oregon, of the economy, of the citizenry. And so those the 2009-11 investment is targeting four major areas, the first being student success. Having funding to support getting more students prepared, enrolled, retained, and completing to a degree. We look toward increasing our OUS enrollment by fall 2010 to over 89,000 students. And this year alone was a record enrollment. We're looking toward hopefully improving that to even a higher number. We're, again, placing particular emphasis on underserved students, the low income, the first generation, and so on, who are making up an increasing proportion of our Oregon adult population. And through these improvements in our in enrollment and retention and graduation, we aim to advance the state's goal of achieving 40% of the adult population in the state with a bachelor's degree or higher by 2025. And so we're this component of the budget moves us in that direction. And I know you're not the committee that's addressing our budget, but I think it's the context in which we're setting our priorities is built on that. The second is affordability, again, increases in the Opportunity Grant, which in combination with continuing modest increases in tuition and campus financial assistance will provide an opportunity for students to go to college, to afford college, and to continue through. We believe that the shared responsibility model approach gives students a stake in paying for their education. And we've seen already, as I know you've heard, what a difference having this funding for the Opportunity Grant has made, and sometimes to surprising result, where it has demand has sometimes outpaced even our best projections. Ultimately, we hope that this approach will help reduce debt for students at graduation, so we hope to see, going back to that first handout, an improvement in the long term in the debt that students have to bear once they graduate. The third area is infrastructure. We're looking at, or the governor's budget proposes, investments of almost $980 million, which is compares to $761 million in 2007-09 in capital construction, repair, and deferred maintenance. This kind of investment will create thousands of jobs in new construction and ancillary jobs on projects on all campuses dispersed throughout the state. And In some cases, these projects could be underway within a matter of weeks. In other cases, a matter of months. This is something that would address some of the immediate economic issues that our state is facing and our country is facing. It also makes significant progress on our deferred maintenance backlog, and it extends student access and safety by providing additional classroom space, improved technology, and seismic readiness. And then the fourth area is clean technologies and innovation. I've mentioned a couple of ONAMI and Oregon Best. Sustainability, again, is a major focus of the board and our system, extending from curriculum through research and operations and so on. So some of the proposals in the budget support that direction and help make some advances. The Oregon Sustainability Center at PSU is one example, looking at four renewable energy projects in Eugene, in Klamath Falls, Corvallis, and then with wind power demonstration projects statewide. So this is across the state. Climate Change Research Institute, OSU, is built into the budget, and an interinstitutional life sciences complex at Portland State, which will be a venue for collaborative work among several institutions and nonprofit organizations as well, providing new jobs in the short run for construction and in the operational phases, but also will incubate new businesses and offer research opportunities to students and interns. With respect to challenges, I think the first challenge is simply maintaining in this very challenging environment, maintaining focus and momentum to continue on and not lose sight, and keep our eye on the ball and not lose sight of where we need to be, both in the short term and in the long term. This is something that higher ed can make Oregon and Oregon's competitiveness sustainable, but it takes a long-term view. More immediately, I think there are demographics that are driving our priorities and our decision-making over both the short and long term that we're needing to plan for now. And I think the last piece in your packet, which is sort of a funny-looking graph that has red and blue squares and diamonds on it, but this graph is intended to show the difference in educational attainment between our younger working age population and the older, the baby boomers, and pretty much the baby boomers, those of us who received our education some time ago or brought it with us from other states. As you know, and I think have already heard, our high level of relatively high level educational attainment is right now partly a product of in-migration, of what has been brought into the state during the 1990s, and particularly as the high-tech industry was developed, and we were importing our best-educated folks. That's not going to continue to happen, and we have a large population that is part of the confluence of demographic changes is that we have a growing diverse population, particularly in the Latino population, which historically has not participated in higher education and is challenged in terms of affordability and other issues in preparation and just in the number of first-generation students and the challenges that poses. So that we will be faced with needing to have more than ever a better educated, younger working age population, but challenged by the demographics that supply that working age population. In the meantime, those of us who are older are retiring, and 20 years from now we'll be well into retirement. This creates a dynamic for Oregon that is critical, and I guess I can't stress enough how critical it is to take that long-term view and look at the investments now as being essential to achieving even just parity, let alone improvements in our own success as a state and as a society. And then the third challenge is that being a geographically diverse state, we have a lot of rural areas that in which educational attainment is about half what it is in the more urbanized areas. And so that creates challenges. The rural areas are often the ones hardest hit in bad economic times and don't have the kind of other resource and infrastructure to rely on. education for the rural populations poses particular challenges, and so that's another area. So we look at the aging baby boomers, what's coming behind, the growing diverse population, and the needs of the rural areas. Those all come together to create some challenges for all of us to deal with. I don't want to dwell on the negative, but we have seen in the past the consequences of disinvestment after ballot measure 5 in the early 90s, when we had to have incredible tuition increases and program reductions and enrollment cuts. We characterized the loss of enrollment during that period as sort of our lost generation. And we've done a little bit of analysis to try to understand better what would have happened had we not lost those students. And if you include the loss to the community colleges and to higher education of what we could have enrolled based on the rate at which we were enrolling students just prior to Measure 5, we could have maintained, at least with the rest of the country, at least at the average, if not higher, of the young working age population having a college degree by the year 2000. But by the year 2000, instead, we were in the bottom third. So if Measure 5 had not happened, had we not had those kinds of cuts and disinvestment, we would have started from a much stronger point at the turn of this century than we did. And so although we've come up a bit since that time with some of the investments, we are not where we could have been. So disinvestment does have an impact. Conversely, we've seen what's happened when the state makes an investment. In 1999, we had an infusion of state dollars that almost immediately resulted in improved freshman participation, improved enrollment, and then 4 to 6 years later, a much higher number of degrees awarded. So we saw tangible results from that single biennium of investment. We're also seeing the results, as I mentioned now, of the investment in last session in the Opportunity Grant and in higher education, that more students, the demand has increased, more students are able to enroll, and we've been able to start making some improvements in what we can build and offer through our programs and institutions. The investment, as I said, will help Oregon now. There are short-term benefits with new jobs through the new construction, and there are long-term benefits through the development of our citizenry with higher educational attainment and a more competitive position in the knowledge economy that is with us and will extend on. I guess as a final word, I would say that it's important to focus not only on those of us who are here now, but on generations that haven't even been born yet. That's what our focus really is looking that far ahead. And I'll stop here and ask if you have any questions. I'd be happy to respond.
Well, thank you for that overview. You're right, this isn't the group that can help you with the budget, except for maybe in one place, that perhaps there is some consolidation of services or within the system. We've talked with the Chancellor's Office about this, and we're going to be looking at this, I think, next month, and be interested to see some data on where those places may be. And by that, I don't mean to suggest for a second that we're closing colleges, but in fact, doing just the opposite, to see if there's a way where we can serve this rural population better and actually make it more affordable and more accessible, especially to that group. So we'll join you with that. Senator Cruth?
Yeah, thank you. Be careful on that. I think former Senator Deckard had a bill once to close Western and ran into some problems with that. But
I think I know who he ran into the problems with.
Well, I wasn't going to say any names. clearly, making college affordable is a very important issue here. And I noticed in your degree partnership programs, Oregon State is partnered with every community college in the state and two in Hawaii. And yet the U of O only has partnerships with two. Why is that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I will need to get that information and bring that back to you if I might. I don't know the answer.
Okay. I mean, it just seems like a huge discrepancy there that Oregon State has. I mean, of course, they've had extension for a long time, and so they've been around the state probably more than others. And it's a fine institution, Senator Moore, so go Beavers. But I think that looks like there's a small gap there in the U of O. Yeah. So.
I think too. It may be just be that Oregon State is ahead in this game, is what it sounds like, and getting toward that seamless system that we all want, and that the others are headed that direction. Yeah. But
I mean,
aren't there
I would
yet.
Think this would be replicable and stuff. So,
and Mr. Chair, that is correct. Oregon State did start early and develop those partnerships early on, but the rest of the system is committed to developing those as well. I will follow up, though, with your specific question, Senator Cruz.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Weeks. This is a very interesting overview, and I have a question about the enrollment figures that are on page 10. If you look back 6-7 years or so, the large institutions, OSU, Oregon, and PSU, were about the same size, close to the same size. But if you look at the enrollment in 2008, PSU has grown significantly faster than U of O and Oregon State. And I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about the factors that go into the determination about enrollment numbers. What considerations are on the table when they're deciding how many students are we taking in? How many can we accommodate? I know U of O has had significant housing issues this year with just a slight increase in enrollment. But if I look at Portland State, and I understand that, you know, it's an urban campus, it's a little bit different than residential colleges, but in terms of that much growth at PSU, what factors are considered in the decision to set those enrollment numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I guess I can offer several and then, again, follow up with something maybe a little bit more cogent. But there are a number of factors. The nature of the student body, the populations, as I know you know, at Portland State, a larger number of part-time working non-traditional students than at the University of Oregon and Oregon State, which has a more traditional student population, which will affect in some ways the scheduling and I will say, as an example of the impact of scheduling, a few years ago, the University of Oregon instituted a discounted tuition for evening, very, you know, later evening classes and really early morning classes that extended opportunities to students, and students took advantage of that. And so sometimes the scheduling and when the classes are available can make a difference in the enrollment. Portland State has been offering programs at almost all hours of the day and night for quite a while because of the nature of their student population. It also, Portland is a rapidly growing area. There's increasing demand, and Portland State has tried very hard to meet as much of that demand as they can. Both University of Oregon and Oregon State have also tried to meet their demand, but it is a different, I think the mission of the campus, the nature and array of programs, and the geographic location, as well as how they target the what's required for their kinds of programs in the way of faculty resource and that sort of thing. All of those things go into a decision about how many students can be accommodated.
Thank
I'm not
you.
Sure if that responded to all of the...
No, that's it. Thank you.
Senator Moore.
Thank you. On the first page, Susan, this is for doctoral granting. Universities looking at the salaries, the comparative salaries. Do you have that same peer group review for the regionals?
We do, and again, shameless promotion.
Okay.
It is in the fact book,
okay.
And I will be happy
book.
To provide
okay.
that
well,
to you. And
my office will probably wind up with a fact book.
I yes, indeed. We will indeed.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. Mr. Chair, we do have an opportunity to do something very good for the universities in this committee, and that's to pass the bill on tuition interest earnings that stay with the university, rather than taking what amounts to students' money and diverting it into general purposes. The trick will be, if we can pass it out, is to keep Ways and Means from offsetting it and saying, well, you're getting a little more money here, so we're going to take it away there.
Let's not tell them we're doing it.
So I would hope that we could entertain that. That major.
Absolutely. Okay.
It'll be our secret.
this week, so we thank you. Look forward to working with you in the coming months.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll close the informational session, and we are adjourned.
Dana, question. Did you mean to ask this?